This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Something funny happened on November 9th, or a lot of funny things, but among them, somewhere way down the list, is this. Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, just took off. In the months after the election, sales of the novel were up 200% compared to the year before, and the book flew to the top of Amazon's literary bestseller list, along with 1984 by George Orwell and other dystopian tales. Now, it's not that the Republican platform called for the enslavement of women, let's not go that far, but somehow, the combination of Mike Pence's very hyper-traditional view of women, let's say, and Donald Trump's kind of Hugh Hefner view of women made a lot of people think very hard about Atwood's novel, where women are divided into wives, housekeepers, and childbearers, and all of them are the property of men. At the Women's March in Washington the day after the inauguration, there was one widely photographed sign that said, "Make Margaret Atwood fiction again." The Handmaid's Tale was published in 1985, and there's a new television adaptation coming from Hulu this month. Margaret Atwood is 77, and she spoke recently with The New Yorker's Rebecca Mead.
I'd love it if you would read a passage for us from early on in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yep.
This is a moment when Offred, the central character, is walking down the street, and we are learning about her world from which she has come.
Yep. And what she says is this. "The sidewalks here are cement. Like a child, I avoid stepping on the cracks. I'm remembering my feet on these sidewalks in the time before and what I used to wear on them. Sometimes it was shoes for running with cushioned soles and breathing holes and stars of fluorescent fabric that reflected light in the darkness. Though I never ran at night, and in the daytime only beside well-frequented roads. Women were not protected then. I remember the rules that were never spelled out, but that every woman knew. Don't open your door to a stranger, even if he says he is the police. Make him slide his ID under the door. Don't stop on the road to help a motorist pretending to be in trouble. Keep the locks on and keep going. If anyone whistles, don't turn to look. Don't go into a laundromat by yourself at night. I think about laundromats, what I wore to them, shorts, jeans, jogging pants, what I put into them, my own clothes, my own soap, my own money, money I had earned myself. I think about having such control. Now we walk along the same street in red pairs, and no man shouts obscenities at us, speaks to us, touches us. No one whistles. There is more than one kind of freedom," said Aunt Lydia. "Freedom to and freedom from. In the days of anarchy, it was freedom to. Now you are being given freedom from. Don't underrate it."
Good Lord. The book is so chilling and so bleak. And I wonder, to write about that world, what kind of toll it took on you while you were doing it?
I think it's a slight myth that writing a book that is working, I mean, when it's working, takes a toll on the writer. I think what takes a toll is when you're writing a book that isn't working out. Mm-hmm. So that is pretty debilitating. But when something is going along quite quickly, you're actually pretty energized.
Even when the world that you're creating is such a it's such a bleak one.
Okay, I didn't create that world. I reflected that world. As far as I was concerned, I was reflecting the world that already existed. I didn't do anything that people hadn't already done, in other words, and therefore were quite capable of doing again. So I was reflecting the world. I wasn't thinking it up. And to that extent, I think it's cathartic to write about those things that are real and to put them out there.
So sales of The Handmaid's Tale rocketed up after the election of Donald Trump, but he's not an exemplar of Puritan values or the kind of values that are described in the novel. So I wondered whether that made sense to you, that the book took off in the way that it did.
He is not, but his a lot of people in his, quotes, base are. So how did they reconcile that? You can do that quite easily, the Bible being such a various document. And you come to the passages where God is using some king or other of reprehensible values to fulfill his plan. So the way they justified it was, well, to put it mildly, he isn't Jesus. But he will help us get some of the righteous things that we want.
I wanted to talk to you about your upbringing. You had a pretty unusual upbringing. Much of your childhood you spent in the remote wilderness of the north of Canada, where your father was studying insect life. And I wondered if you could talk to me a little bit about what that was like up there.
Okay, so it wasn't so unusual then as it would be now. It was pretty remote at that time. I think when he first went to that location, there was no road. So very technology light. So no electricity, no running water, no flush toilets, books, shortwave radio, but all you could really get on it was Russia. And that was it.
So how did you spend your time?
Well, when we were of school age, which wasn't, of course, for the first 5 years or so, my mother would just get the workbooks from the school and we would fill them out. And if you filled them out really quickly, then you could do whatever you liked. So it made me superficial and speedy.
Characteristics you're very well known for.
And it's true.
I'm a
very fast reader, for instance.
How do you think that this experience of this kind of childhood shaped the kind of writer that you became?
Very luckily, I'm not my own biographer. I'm deeply grateful for that. I'm not my own psychiatrist. So I don't even want to speculate on that, because in order to make any meaningful statement about it at all, I would have to have another me. And that other me would have grown up in some other way. And then we could compare the me that I am with that other me, genetically identical, who had grown up in some other way. And then we could say something about it. You see, I did grow up with the biologist. So we just don't say anything about these things unless you can actually say something meaningful, accurate.
Right. You mentioned to me when we were talking at one point about wanting to be the kind of girl who got to wear a frilly print dress, but your mother didn't let you have a frilly print dress.
No, it's not that she didn't let me. It didn't occur to her. It wasn't in her head.
Right.
So if I had said, I want a frilly pink dress, maybe she would have got me one, but of course I was not a very demanding child in that way. So I think my mother went shopping, mother-daughter shopping, that big cliche. I think that happened to me once.
Do you remember what you bought?
Absolutely. The first high school formal, we got an ice blue brocade formal. And in those days, you got the brocade shoes dyed to match. So she underwent that with me. I think it was a big sacrifice. You have to understand that my dad picked out her clothes.
Uh-huh.
She was not interested in it.
So the gender roles in your house were quite unusual for the time.
They were unusual but not reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was that period of culture, and you can go back and read sort of how-to books for wives and husbands of the, I think from the Edwardian age until after the war, it was the sort of chums model, you know, that your spouse was supposed to be your chum or your pal. That may seem unusual now, but it wasn't so unusual for the time. They just had a lot of activities that they loved to do, and they could do chums things together, like like canoe trips. But you don't do canoe trips in a frilly dress.
That's right. I love the chums model of marriage.
Yes.
Do you remember a first moment or an early moment of experiencing sexism or recognizing it?
Well, you didn't call it that.
Mm.
I mean, you could go back and describe stuff that happened,
mm-hmm.
but it wouldn't have been called sexism. For instance, I was of the age when there was these schoolhouses that were built probably in the 19th century out of red brick. And there was the girls' playground and the boys' playground. And so boys could come onto that side and play marbles, but you could not go onto the other side and play soccer. So gender roles, definitely there were gender roles. But nobody thought anything about it, because when you're in the middle of something like that, it seems normal to you.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem entirely normal to me because of how I grew up, but I was very interested in it.
Did you ever have that experience of thinking, God, I wish I was a boy? It's better for them.
No, I didn't. Sorry. I suppose because I wasn't wildly discriminated against growing up as a girl. I wasn't told that there were a lot of things I couldn't do because I was a girl.
Lucky you.
Well, lucky me. I think a lot of the people I went to high school with and even college with were, because they'd come from communities, and you can read all about this in Alice Munro, in those small town communities, about the worst thing that could happen to you was that you would be laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I missed that part. I think you kind of have to have missed that part if you're going to be a writer, because you risk making an idiot of yourself every time you publish something.
You have to have missed the crippling self-consciousness of adolescence or youth.
Well, I think, I think everybody's a bit self-conscious about some things, such as their appearance. So I did all of the things that people probably do, which is different shades of lipstick and what do I look like upside down. And
mm-hmm.
But I don't recall being crippled by it. Were you crippled by crippling self-consciousness?
I'm crippled by it right this second. No, I'm joking.
No. Awful.
No. I wanted to ask you about the feminist label. This is something that in the past I've read that you've sort of slightly balked at being described as a feminist writer.
It's because there are so many meanings of that word. I'm very happy to put my hand up for one box that says feminist on it, but there are a lot of other boxes. So which box labeled feminist are we talking about?
Which box labeled feminist are you?
The one I'd put my hand up for.
Mm.
Women are human beings. Hand mm-hmm. up. Yes, I'm for that. fairness in hiring practices. Fairness mm-hmm. in equal pay for work of equal value. Reforming the legal system so that there is a better process for dealing with sexual assault crimes. Hands up. However, human beings often do wonderful things, and human beings can also do terrible things. And if women are human beings, they're not exempt from doing terrible things. So Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. But she got off on that because the feminists of the day said a woman could not ever possibly do a murder like that. Wrong. Mm-hmm. What I'm not for is some notion that women, because they're women, are, by virtue of being women, more virtuous and noble.
Mm-hmm. You've written so many books, and so many of them are still so widely read. There's Alias Grace is being adapted as a miniseries too, so we're lucky this year in having both Hulu doing The Handmaid's Tale and Netflix doing Alias Grace. But probably the book that's going to define you is The Handmaid's Tale.
Well,
are you okay
Will I care? I assume at the point at which it's going to define me, I will be dead. Is that what we're saying?
I suppose that's a very healthy way to look at it.
Yeah, well, it's not going to actually bother me one way or the other once I'm dead. I mean, people keep asking me, so what do you think your legacy is going to be? Said, well, you know, apart from pieces of property that I'm leaving to my descendants, what are you talking about?
But
you see, time moves on. And what typically happens to a well-known writer when they die is, first of all, they have a big uptick as everybody either goes boo-hoo or else boo. You know, they get both evaluated and denounced. And then people lose interest because it's a new and different generation. And then after a while, you know, it happened to George Eliot, then you might get a resurgence, or you might not. You might just vanish into oblivion. And that will also depend on what government is in power and what the literary fashions of the day are. One hopes there will be readers. One hopes people will still be reading books. I think that would be wonderful. And if they are still reading books, maybe they will read some of my books, but it will be as it is now. That is, some people like them, other people don't.
Right.
This is a small thing in the history of humanity. Of course, being Canadian, I'm always saying things like that. we go in for self-balloon puncturing just so nobody will accuse us of having a swelled head.
Margaret Atwood talking with The New Yorker's Rebecca Mead. Rebecca wrote a profile of Margaret Atwood, and you can find that piece at newyorkerradio.org. Hulu's adaptation of Atwood's Handmaid's Tale premieres on April 26th, and Netflix's Alias Grace comes later this year.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.